In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench. Hello there, sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show.
Hello, welcome back to Fighting on Film. As we approach the big 150 next week, we thought we'd pack a couple of films around the 150, detailing some of the movies that have been on the Fighting on Film Google Drive since we started the show in 2021. Yeah. If you're a long-time listener, if you're a short-term listener, we might as well explain it. So when we started the show, we made this database of like 100-odd films, and it's pretty much been untouched. we haven't really used it. So every now and then we kind of dip in. We go, oh, yeah, that one will work. Matt's
continually been wanting to add to it, but we do not subtract to it.
Yes, exactly.
That's the problem.
and Matt has been wanting to do The Real Glory for a while. He's pitched it as a Patreon pick for a few times, mm-hmm. and it's sort of kind of flown under the radar. So we'll dust this one off and give it a watch. This week's film is The Real Glory.
It's a really interesting one because it covers a topic that you really wouldn't expect 1930s Hollywood to cover.
Yeah.
And it's a conflict that hasn't really been, you know, looked at in film
before or since.
And it's the first film to tackle the Filipino insurrection, the Moro Rebellion.
Yeah. But interestingly, the first time I ever heard about this war was in a Playboy magazine from the 60s.
No way.
That I bought to do my Vietnam reenactment with. And it had like a little write-up about one of the big battles in there, which was really interesting. Yeah.
Wow.
Crazy.
The Hef just being like, yeah, get that... get that Moro Rebellion article in there this month.
Get that in there.
Definitely the boys need a palate cleanser.
They do, yeah. Center page and then Spanish-American War. So it's just what the boys need. Oh, and we should mention as well before we jump off the new T-shirt design that Serbit dropped.
Oh, yeah. So we've got a new... we've gone for a nice, big, bold, simple T-shirt design to celebrate the 150. We are dropping it this week, so check out fightingonfilm.com. It's available in white, it's available in black and navy, unisex, all sizes, and it's a film reel like frame with Fighting on Film, the war movie podcast, written in the middle of it. And I think it looks good. I like it. I've ordered
it looks
one,
lovely.
So, you know,
Matt designed it in-house, and that's available for under £20. We've kept it as cheap as we can.
Kept it really cheap on this one. There's a couple of other ones up on there already, but this one we've tried to keep really affordable. If you want to, you can rep the show in T-shirt form.
Yeah, please do. Please do. We'd love to see it.
There's a mug as well. There's a mug.
Oh, and there's a mug. There you go.
Ceramic mug. Exciting times.
You can have a brew when you watch a movie, haven't you?
Exactly.
You do.
No stand to until we've had a brew.
Exactly. That used to be a slogan, didn't it? We sort of dropped it.
As we've said since like the third episode. Yeah.
We dropped it for no undiscernible reason. It doesn't always fit, no. Maybe I should just jump into the production this week.
I tell you what, I'll give a little bit of context on what the film's about first.
That's probably a good idea.
Because it's such an obscure subject. So it's set in 1906 during the Moro Rebellion, and the Moro were a predominantly Muslim group in the Philippines. The rebellion followed the Philippine-American War, which was a result of the Spanish-American War, because Spain ceded ownership of the Philippines to the US, along with a couple of other protectorates and colonies, essentially, after Spain's defeat in 1898. And then, essentially, the Philippines become like an unincorporated protectorate, a territory. And they are essentially later on called a Commonwealth, but they're essentially a protectorate of the United States. And there's an insurgency by the Moro from as soon as the Americans arrive through to about 1913. And the film is set in, as I said, 1906. And it follows a isolated fort in Mindanao, in the forest. And the Moro are trying to lure the Americans out of the fort because they can't attack the fort because it's too strong. There's some really interesting parallels with, later approaches to counterinsurgency, where they try and train up the local forces to replace American forces, because we've seen that again in Vietnam and Afghanistan with varying degrees of success.
Mm-hmm.
ISAF,
aren't they?
it's just a really interesting film in that there's so many parallels with what would follow, and they tried the same approaches. But there's lots for us to talk about in terms of Ali Kit.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
Some good stuff in
colonialism, imperialism themes, and also filmmaking-wise. So, yeah, dive in, Rob.
So the film was produced by Samuel Goldwyn, really famous Polish producer, that golden Hollywood era of the 30s, 40s. Mm. It's distributed by United Artists, and Goldwyn also produced 30s and 40s hits such as Raffles in 39 with David Niven, Pride of Yankees, another Gary Cooper movie, and 1943 is The First of the Few, which is the film about the creation of the Spitfire, also starring David Niven. So it's directed by Californian director Henry Hathaway, who directed 7 Cooper pictures during his career, including The Life of a Bengal Lancer, which this film is kind of like a bit of a retread. 1937's The Souls at Sea. He also directed a few war films as well in the 40s and 50s, including 1944's Wing and a Prayer, 1951's The Desert Fox, and then 1971's Raid on Rommel, which had Burton in it, if you remember.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's not a bad one.
One of Burton's many desert war films.
Yeah, yeah.
Did didn't he?
Sober him up in the desert, perhaps. Maybe that's why they,
The heat.
Cinematography was by Hungarian-born Rudolf Mate, or Mate, not quite sure how you say that one, who worked on Sahara. That one's coming soon to the pod. The Pride of the Yankees and Foreign Correspondent, which, good films, good, decent cinematography for its day. There's some nice shots in there. The film cost $2 million, massive budget for its time. Gary Cooper was paid over $480,000 of that, becoming the highest paid actor that year. The shoot took 200 days, longer than the actual Spanish-American War itself, and was filmed at Samuel Goldwyn Studios in West Hollywood and other Californian locations, and the sets cost $200,000. This is no small production. I've got a little thing from the Kinematograph Weekly detailing more on the production. So they say sound effects for Samuel Goldwyn's production in Real Glory are being carried on 22 cables stretched under 1.5 million gallons of running water for the Philippine sequences. The feat of electrical construction was completed under the direction of Thomas Moulton, chief of Goldwyn's sound department. The set, comprising 6 acres, was built by a crew of 500 men under Ralph Angel, studio construction foreman, working from US Army photographs. The lagoon required 40,000 square feet of asphalt and is 400 feet long and 6 feet deep. 6-inch head of water will pour over the dam constantly, and a 5-ton boom set on a pontoon was designed to give the cameras natural movement in following actions. Wow. Yeah. So this is like crazy.
That great tracking shot of when they're attacking the fort, isn't there? And it kind of like rolls backwards as they come on. That's quite a good shot.
It's really, really good. And it was also reported in the Falkirk Herald on the July 5th, 1939, that 150 pounds of black hair had to be sourced for the film after Goldwyn found that his Filipino extras had contemporary short hairstyles, and he got 200 wigs made. And apparently there was like a scarce amount of like black hair for use in movies, and apparently most of it at the time was being used for this film.
What a weird fact.
I know. I just came across it and I was like, that's got to go in. And the article that it was in, it was like, oh, it may annoy some that you can't get any black hair right now, and it's because of this. So I was like, interesting.
Everyone was very put out by that.
The Falkirkians were up in arms. It was released on September 29th, 1939, and December 26th, 1939, here in the UK. Was later reissued under the title A Yank in the Philippines, but it was withdrawn in 1942 by the Motion Picture Division of the Office of War Information, as the Moros were now allies of the US after they entered the war in 41. So they didn't want to have any bad blood between them, so that the film got sort of withdrew. And there was quite some controversy, actually, relating to the scene where the prisoner is threatened to be buried in a pigskin. And this was said to be from a memoir from General Pershing called My Life Before the War. And apparently a Muslim fighter had supposedly been buried next to a dead pig. But apparently that claim since been debunked and discredited by historians.
Yeah,
and
apparently claims about bullets getting dipped in.
Yeah, that's
pig
another
fat
thing.
And stuff like that. So it's haram and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, but that's apparently that's all been debunked. And the film has sort of propped up this myth of US troops doing that. But apparently it didn't happen, according to sources.
Interesting.
Which is interesting. Yeah, I couldn't find any solid stuff on that, but it's there nonetheless. So the retro review is from Kinematograph Weekly, November 30, 1939, and they lead with spectacular romantic comedy melodrama reenacting many of the events and circumstances that led to the colonization of the Philippines by the Americans. The central characters have foibles of their own, and these decorate the story background. The many interests, none of them unduly hampered by history, collaborate as the yarn methodically develops into the promotion of as thrilling and exhilarating climax as any yet seen on the screen. The resolute, if belated, conquest of box office spectacle is led magnificently by Gary Cooper. He and the first-rate supporting cast are seen at their best. Star values seal the entertainment's certain success and excellent popular booking. That's as clippy as a review you're ever going to get from Kinematograph Weekly. They love a clippy review, don't they?
How did they describe the film genre-wise at the beginning there?
A spectacular romantic comedy melodrama.
A romantic comedy melodrama. That is so far off point.
I know. It's not bizarre. Really that. Wow. There's a love triangle in there, I know that. But
there
it's
is.
Not.
There's elements of a lot of things, but we'll talk about that later on, I'm sure.
So the One Word reviews are back this week after a week off. And we've got a few, not as many as in the past, but I think this movie is one that probably not many have seen. So R. Burgos goes with Juramentados or Juramentados. Yep. Stephen O'Neill said, still waiting on Play Dirty. We'll get to that one, don't worry. Ian McClellan said, Wish List. Paul said, P.K.R. Burns said, new to me. Does that count as one word? You put like hyphens in, so I guess it does. Simon Whippet put Young Cooper, and Ian Gorry goes with Unknown. So it's a bit of a mixed bag there.
Yeah, I don't think many people have seen this one, which is classic Foff. There
classic.
We go.
Classic. It's Matthew's fault this week, not mine.
It is. It's available on Amazon, I believe, and I think there might also be a version of it up on YouTube. There's a number of different ones.
YouTube. There's a few versions of it out there, to be fair.
I think perhaps it's out of copyright. I do not know.
It could be.
But there's a lot of there's a lot of versions of it up on there, but definitely is on Amazon as well. I guess that leads us into cast.
It does, yeah.
So as we already know, it's led by Gary Cooper, who plays Dr. Bill Canavan, who throughout I thought was Dr. Bill Caravan, which not quite correct. And he plays like the most combatant, non-combatant known to man.
Yeah. He loves drawing his pistol.
Where he's like a doctor who basically just takes over command towards the end of the film.
He's essentially playing a cowboy, though, isn't it, really?
They all are. And Corbin actually described the film as a Western.
Yeah, you can see it.
I was reading bits of some of David Niven's biographies and his own autobiography. And he talks about his role in this, where he describes it as simply a good part. He doesn't go into any more detail about the film at all. He just basically skips onto Raffles, which, understandably, because that was the lead part for him. So, as I said, Gary Cooper, Wings 1927, Legion of the Condemned 28, Morocco 1930, A Farewell to Arms in 1932, The Lives of a Bengal Lancer, which we mentioned a moment ago, 1935, Beau Guest, 38, Sergeant York in 1941, For Whom the Bell Tolls in 43, Unconquered in 47, Task Force in 49, Distant Drums in 51, and They Came to Cadora in 1959, which is really interesting one we'll have to cover at some point about Medal of Honor recipients. And he's escorting them back to get their medals. And it's, it turns out that they're all not... It's kind of like Meet Your Heroes kind of thing. And he's like, I need to get them back, but they're all turning out to be not the best people. Really interesting movie.
Sounds good, that.
David Niven, Gary Cooper. Yeah, Gary Cooper's pretty good. I don't think he's as... tour de force in this as he could have been.
No, he's not. As Tony Soprano said, the strong silent type.
Yeah. There's not a lot for him to do, really.
No, there's not. That's it. This was maybe Goldwyn sort of like stealing him from bigger projects to sort of get him in this. Couldn't really get a lead on that, but it seemed like Cooper wasn't too pleased to be doing Beau Guest the year before and then essentially be doing kind of the same thing.
He does have a run of doing this sort of film, that's for sure. You know, like an adventure, military-based film.
Well, the Swashbuckley adventurers were popular back then, weren't they, as well?
They were popular. David Niven's character is Lieutenant Terence McCool.
What a name.
That's literally, they could just call him Niven, like, at this point, like, because he's playing Niven, as he always
Terence
does.
Terence McBastard. No.
And... I love the way they actually introduce his character, because they do that classic trope of showing the photograph of the character in like a dossier.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
great.
This has got to be like one of the earliest examples of a military film doing a photograph in a dossier.
A cliche, maybe it created the cliche.
Because the general puts down like a series of like personnel folders.
Get me McCool. Yeah,
I need McCool, and then he describes him as like a one man army.
Yeah,
which. You'd never heard David Niven described as a one-man army before, but love it.
I say I'm a one-man army. How lovely for me. How lovely.
So, of course, other military films from Niven's career include The Charge of the Light Brigade, 1936, definitely one we have to cover. Dawn Patrol, 38, definitely another one we have to cover. The Way Ahead, we have covered. A Matter of Life and Death in 46, Soldiers 3 in 51, which is a good adventure film, Carrington VC in 55.
Love that.
The Guns of Navarone in 1961, which we might be covering soon, I don't know. The Captive City in 1962, The Best of Enemies, which we watched recently and
That's
were pleasantly
really
surprised by.
It's so funny.
Just needed a little bit more to it, a little bit of substance.
It needed a little action
scene
near the end to really cement it, but it was still good.
Before Winter Comes, 69, Paper Tiger, 1975, which you mentioned in our episode about the Peyton film.
Yeah.
Escape to Athena, 1979, and of course, The Sea Wolves in 1980. The cast is rounded out by Andrea Leeds, who plays Linda Hartley, the love interest. She retired the next year after she got married.
Oh, wow.
Reginald Owen plays Captain Steve Hartley, her father. He played Dr. Watson in the 1932 adaptation of Sherlock Holmes. He was in Conquest, which you mentioned earlier, Rob, in 37. A Yank in the Raff in 41. Mrs. Miniver the next the year after.
Wow.
Simon Tim Brittany in 43. He was in Three Musketeers in 1948. Derby's Rangers in 1958.
Nice.
And he was Major General Sir Brian Teagler in Bedknobs and Broomsticks, which we have actually covered on the show.
Yes. Love it.
And then we've got Broderick Crawford, who plays Lieutenant or Lieutenant Larson. He was in Boguest, Last of the Comanches in 53.
Wow, boy. That one.
Up from the Beach in 1965, which is one we've got on the list, on the Fable Foff film list.
That's a hard one to track down, that, apparently.
Yeah. Mutiny at Fort Sharp, 1966. Guerrilla Strike Force, a Filipino film from 1987 as well.
Ooh.
That was his last sort of military role. Might be one to like dig out of that one, I think. Rudy Robles plays Lieutenant Yabo, who is the only Filipino actor that has any lines in this film.
Yeah, shocking.
The representation of Filipinos with speaking roles in this film is dire.
Quite bad, yep. Aged very badly.
And then we've got Vladimir Sokolov, who plays Datu, who is kind of like the Ali Pang, who is the Moro leader. Datu's character is essentially like an advisor or lieutenant. He's like the second in command. He's also a bit of a spy. Sokolov was one of those ethnically ambiguous actors of the Hollywood golden era, where he could play almost anything, like European, Mexican, Filipino.
And they made him play everyone they could as well.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. So he was
Hire Indigenous Actors Challenge. Impossible back then.
Impossible. Impossible. Like, I'll talk about that in a second as well.
Mm.
So we got West Front 1918, the 1930 film. He was in that as a background extra. Hell on Earth in 1931, which is a really interesting film that we need to cover. That's another World War One drama. Conquest in 1937, so another nice link there to a film we mentioned earlier. West of Shanghai the same year, Blockade in 1938, which is one of those rare Spanish Civil War movies. It's got Henry Fonda in the lead.
I think we talked about that before.
Then, of course, For Whom the Bell Tolls in 43, Passage to Marseille in 44, Back to Bataan in 45, and probably most recognizable to a lot of people for The Magnificent Seven in 1960, where he plays the village elder type. Then we've got Then we've got Testu Kamai, who plays Ali Pang. Again, not a Filipino, playing a Filipino role.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Tell It to the Marines in 1926, The War Correspondent in 1932, West of Shanghai, again with Sokolov in 1937, Task Force with Cooper in 49, and Tank Battalion in 1958.
Oh, nice.
And that kind of rounds out the basic cast. It's really interesting reading about the production of the show, because apparently they cast 1,200 Filipino extras for the film. And you've already mentioned the fact that they had trouble getting the right wigs for them and stuff like that. New York Times article I found states that they were supervised by Senor Demandante and Mrs. Padres. Padres was the daughter-in-law of the Philippine ambassador to the US at the time.
Oh, wow.
So one of the interesting things that kind of sits between cast and production almost is that the Philippine government at the time really weren't pleased with the film and the way it portrayed Filipino soldiers, the Filipino constabulary in the film. And they repeatedly asked for changes, and Goldwyn was apparently quite reluctant. But I found an issue of the Philippine magazine from 1939, volume 36, number 10, if anyone wants to go and find it. And there's a very short little section which says, President Quezon is informed by cable from Samuel Goldwyn, Hollywood film producer, that he has taken out scenes in The Real Glory which allegedly reflect on courage of the Filipinos as soldiers, and which were cause of protest voiced through Commissioner Elizalde, who was the Filipino diplomat to the US Congress. He was kind of like a non-voting congressman for the territory essentially. So it seems that there was some back and forth about various scenes showing how reluctant the Filipino constabulary were to fight the Moro, you know, and that fear of the
Not in the film
swordsmen and stuff
because they're raring to go.
So I mean, there's bits of that in there, isn't it? And then it shows Cooper Riley, you know, showing them that the Moro aren't to be feared as much as they, you know,
General Cooper, because he pretty much becomes the commander.
He does essentially, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I also found a note that kind of quotes the general thoughts of Elizalde, and it says he requested the deletion of the scenes that depicted his people as inferior, morally afraid of the Moro tribe, and reflected in general against the courage of the Commonwealth.
Uh-huh.
So, again, kind of iterates how unhappy the Filipino government were to see how Goldwyn and the film had portrayed the constabulary. Interesting stuff. And that basically rounds out cast. I did find out that Niven was on about $1,000 a week.
Wow.
Yeah, on his weekly rate.
Not earning what Cooper was on. Christ.
No, not quite, but, you know, pretty good for the day, that's got to be said.
Not bad, grand. Blimey.
Critics praised Cooper's performance, including Graham Greene, who said he'd never acted better.
Which
is interesting, because I feel like he had.
I think he's done better work.
Yeah.
I think they've all done better work.
And then the only other thing I found in terms of cast production, Colonel William Shutan was the technical advisor on the film, and he was the former military governor of Mindanao, where the film was set.
Nice.
And he served during the Spanish-American War and later during the First World War as well.
Wow. So talking about advising and things like that, we should probably move into this week's Alley Tally.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's time for Alley Tally on Fighting on Film.
I quite like seeing the Krag Jorgensen rifles, because you don't often see them.
You really do not often see them at all. Like, there's a handful of films. There's 4th of April, the Danish movie that has them in. What else has them in? They're prominently in the film Dale Dye advised about the Spanish-American War. They're in that.
Right.
There's not many films.
No, there isn't. They're not interesting, because they've got that big metal box next to the bolt.
Yeah, it's cool, because like that's hinged and it pops out to the side. You don't really see it in the film. You see it a little bit. There's a bit where Ali Pang is kind of like playing with one.
Fiddling around, yeah.
And that little, like, it's hinged and that little box opens out and you just drop the rounds in and you close it. So it's quite a clever design.
Interesting. Because I know
that. You have to actually open the action to load the rifle.
That's interesting. Because I know they're from Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah.
And the animation on that is you open the bolt when he puts rounds in. So it must.
Well, there's no need. What are you doing, Rockstar? Hey,
can you hear that, Rockstar? Hear that, Take Two Interactive? You got that wrong. Yeah, no, but it's nice to see them. And I think we did some research and we found that it's a a shortened constabulary carbine version.
Yeah, yeah, the 1890, was it 96 we found?
Yeah, something like that. Late 1890s, which is nice.
They were taken from like the 1892, the long infantry model, and shortened down and altered by armories and such. Very interesting.
So no, I love it. I think the Ali Tally is interesting because it's the early 1900s and it's something we don't really see in the film, like on film very often. You know, there's hardly any Boer War movies. There's not many Zulu War movies. So, you know, there isn't much representation. Well, I'm sure there is plenty of representation out there of that period. But in terms of what we've covered on the show, we haven't really come across it very often.
Well, as we said at the beginning, there's definitely not many films about this, you know, particular rebellion.
Gosh, no.
And that's one of the things that drew me to the film. And I really wanted to cover it because it's so interesting in terms of, you know, kit that's in there and also the period it's set in. And you get Niven on a Gatling gun.
Oh,
you get David Niven firing not one, but two different types of Gatling
gun. Two types of Gatling, yeah. Do you want
to
tell
us what they are? He's on a grand a week, Rob, and he's also getting to fire Gatling guns.
How lovely for me.
Living the dream.
To be firing a Gatling gun. Lovely.
Marvellous.
Marvellous.
Why are our Niven impressions completely nothing like Niven? We're just doing archetypal posh Brit.
Yeah, I say. This Gatling gun is rather fun.
Very drunk.
Yes. You just turn the crank and it goes rat-a-tat-tat.
Oh, God. I wish he'd written that in his autobiography.
You turn the crank and it goes rat-a-tat-tat.
Yeah. Oh, my God, I love it.
Oh, it's brilliant. No, it's really great to see it, though, and it's lovely. I love seeing Gatling guns in anything. I think they're so interesting.
Again, you mostly just see them in Westerns. And
yeah, you do.
Perhaps because Goldwyn considered this film a Western, he was like, I need Gatling guns.
We need Gatlings. Because it would have been not, it wouldn't not been Gatlings, would it? Would it have been?
I think they're plausible. They're definitely plausible for being there. You know, some might have been something that was handed over to the constabulary because at that point, you know, they got machine guns and such. But not only do you get the classic Gatling gun with the box magazine at the top, but you also get a Colt Model 1883, which is really cool because it's all brass and it's like the shortened version.
Yeah, that's nice.
Like, that's the pinnacle. That's the pinnacle of the Gatling gun. Like, it's evolved.
The Cadillac of Gatling guns.
the Cadillac of Gatlings. It's the best a man can get in terms of Gatling guns. And it's essentially like they evolved it from about 1865. And the 83 model is lightweight, entirely encased in like brass. And it feeds from an Ackles drum, which is a big, high capacity sort of like donut shaped thing on top of it. Really cool. Possibly like the only one I've ever seen in a film as well.
Like the scene where he brings it in because it implies that they either move the one he's already fired or they've got another one and they're like putting it up on a high emplacement and you've got like three lads and Niven like trying to put it on the plinth. It's great. I just love seeing it.
I would have loved to have seen him like smash another box magazine into that, the one that's on the parapet.
You get one, you don't get two, do you?
Yeah.
Because he calls for more ammunition, doesn't he? And at that point, the Morrow have stolen it.
The world. We'll talk about the climax, I'm sure.
God, there's parts of that annoy me. Anyway, but there's another Niven bit that I absolutely adore, and I had to say it on the Ali Tally rather than favourite scene. So the bit where the Morrows are stealing the rifles and the ammunition. Yeah. Niven notices and he goes over and he's injured already, I think, at this point. Or he's, you know, because he's had malaria. So
suffering from cholera, isn't he?
Cholera, that's it. Yeah. And he kind of goes over.
It's not going to stop me.
I know. Bout of cholera won't stop me.
Touch of the cholera won't stop me.
Not me, David McCool Niven. So he draws his Colt army and he just gives them six rounds and it's the most Western you'll ever see Niven.
It's very nice, man, actually.
It is good.
Firing from the hip.
And it's all like smoke.
Six Morrow.
Oh, it's great. It's just it. I might have to make that a GIF. Because it's so cool. Just Niven drawing that revolver. So cool.
There's another scene that I really like that's centered around the revolver. So the Colt New Army is a 38 caliber revolver and it was adopted in like the 1890s. To replace the Colt single action army, like, you know, the classic Western, single action revolver. And there's a great opening sequence in the film where a Morrow swordsman, a attacks the colonel.
Yes.
Cuts him down. And the three lieutenants, that have arrived to join the command, all open fire. So that's like 18 rounds going into so this good. Guy. And it doesn't drop him. And there's a great little sequence. He finally falls, like, after someone else fires a couple of rounds as well. And there's a great sequence where Cooper comes into the mess and he's just done an autopsy on the Morrow, swordsman. Yeah. And he drops a series of slugs onto the table.
Yeah.
And he says, I thought I'd missed that chap, but I hadn't. I dug out more lead from him than, they could sink a battleship or something like that.
It's great.
And that is a really interesting inclusion because there's documented accounts of 38 revolvers not having the stopping power that was needed to stop a fanatic. During the Philippine war and in the insurrection. And that is one of the driving forces that led the US military to move towards the 45 caliber pistol.
Interesting.
Because they were searching for that kind of stopping power that was needed.
Urgent procurement issues.
Right.
They actually pod on
started
that.
Just reissuing Colt single action armies in 45 Colt.
Cool. A bit heavier cartridge.
Yeah, just a big beefy like lead slug.
A beefy boy.
But I just was really fascinated that they included that.
That's nice. It's a nice detail
to include.
I like seeing the gun belts. That's cool. That's that adds into the Western thing. Bandoliers. The shotgun with the Winchester.
Yeah.
And
there's nothing cooler than when Gary Cooper walks over to that chest for the first time, just casually opens it up and reaches in and pulls out an Winchester 1897 riot shotgun.
Yeah.
And nonchalantly saunters off.
It's very cool. But then no one ever fires one. I think there's one gets fired once.
Yeah. So there's that sequence, which is a very classic adventure movie where he's being chased by some rebels. He runs across a rope bridge. Of course it's a rope bridge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And he fires a single round. He doesn't shoot the guys chasing him. He just shoots the one of the side ropes of the rope bridge, and it snaps, and they plunge to their deaths. And he hangs on for grim life.
The guy falls down as well. I always think about that stuntman there. I'm like, that didn't look safe. He just drops 30 foot or something. And the bit, oh my God, the bits where the Morrow in Ironclad, it just made me laugh. Themselves.
It's insane.
Into the fort, and there's a shot of a guy hitting the side of a bit of set, and it looks genuinely painful. And then one of them gets flung through a glass window.
You're ruining my favorite scene.
Sorry, but it's just laughable. Pick. I'm like, what are they
doing? It really is. There's some proper gash, like Hollywood stuff going on. There's a bit where a guy throws a spear downwards. And it cuts to the pickup shot of it hitting
it's
him,
up.
And it goes upwards into him.
I loved it. I love stuff like that. I just love it. Like
the bits with the when Mike Miguel and the young lad like stops Cooper from going any further and triggers a booby trap, and it's like just some spears that get fired out of a bamboo tube. Like what is throwing those?
I thought you meant the bit where Gary's pushing that spire log, and he stops because there's a punji pit.
Straight into a punji pit, yeah.
And Gary gives it the most shove ever. Like, come on.
He's like, why aren't you moving? I've completely forgotten about the traps. Why are you moving? He pushes that too and goes straight into a pit.
Just made me laugh.
That was
so
gnarly,
much.
Actually. Like, there's
that was good.
There's a couple of shots in this film where they really linger. So there's a bit where, spoilers, one of the lieutenants is killed trying to destroy the dam. A dam is built.
1939, Matt. I don't think it's a spoiler.
Yeah, it's probably people not
have,
a spoiler.
It's September 39. People had a bit more going on than what the real glory was happening. There's this bloke called Hitler, and he was getting a bit mad.
Oh, my God. Well, yeah, they didn't get around to watching it because things were going on wrong.
Exactly, so yeah.
Spoiler. So one of the lieutenants is sort of like being shown to be eaten by ants, like his body's being eaten by ants.
Yeah.
Which is
apparently that scene had 20,000 ants, I found out, apparently.
Apparently so, and they had like the Hollywood's top insect guy.
Top insect. Goldwyn was sparing no it. Money. Goldwyn was no like, I've got 2 mil and I'm going to go in,
We're doing this. That shot that we used about 2/15ths of a second of because we couldn't get it past.
I can't make fake ants. Okay, I gotta get 20,000 ants. All right.
get me a fake skull and 20,000.
Get many ants for this Cooper picture.
I need 20,000 didgeridoos. And this, if you know that reference, then
yeah,
more power to you. And then there's the bit where there's a very brief bit where you see the kennel getting hacked, and then there's the major that also gets hacked to death as well.
Yeah, it's quite brutal.
Some really actually quite brutal, yeah. Like visceral bits in
especially
this.
The bit where Cooper finds all the chaps that have been cut to bits up on the trail.
Spears in them and stuff.
And the guy's been like buried up to his head, and it looks like he's been stabbed and all. That's quite for 39.
Yeah, that's the ant scene. Like, that's the dude getting eaten by
that
ants.
That is the ant scene. Yeah, of course it is. Yeah. Some of the ants were busy for me. They were chomping away. They were having a lovely old time.
They buried him fast, didn't they? Because it pans up and there's the orchid that he loves. So, you know, again, bit of context for anyone.
Fucking flower boy. So boring.
One of the lieutenants is obsessed with orchids. And he comes across as a very sort of like simple soul, but he loves them orchids.
He's like Chumley Warner, isn't he? He's just like a bit bumbling fool. Yeah.
Last thing on the Alitalia, actually two things. One, the Hotchkiss mountain gun that gets briefly used to like blow a hole in the wall.
That's nice.
Where did they get that from?
God knows.
They're like struggling to get Craig Jorgensen's, but they've got a Hotchkiss mountain gun.
Well, I thought it'd be having handy.
Datu's like, we need these amazing multi-shot Craig Jorgensen rifles. And yes. and Ali Pang's like, oh, is it as good as the Hotchkiss mountain gun that we have?
Hotchkiss mountain gun I somehow purloined. Yeah.
And then it just, you know, a shout out to the eternal look of bandoliers, slouch hats, or bush hats.
It's a strong look.
And like jungle KD type.
It's nice.
And puttees. There's a bit where Gary Cooper says, "Have you seen my puttees?" And I was like, wow, okay.
Wow.
This is quite the film.
Yeah. And a shout out to Niven just not doing any accent. I just love it.
Yeah, Niven's Niven's
did he
Niven.
Ever do an accent in his entire career?
I've never seen a film where Niven hasn't done Mid-Atlantic or really British.
No, because there's no other movie. There's no movie on Earth.
The closest he gets is Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Yeah. But it's just funny to
really
me.
He doesn't go in for that.
Niven's just Niven, isn't he? It doesn't matter who you are playing. You're just Niven, aren't you? So great.
He does that thing that Tom Hanks now does where he's Tom Hanks.
Yeah, actually, that's very true. Yeah.
It's like, you've cast Tom Hanks. You've cast David Niven. David Niven's going to do David Niven, and it's going to be great.
Denzel Washington's in that.
But I think, as always, yes, he totally is. But as always, we've sort of spiraled into favorite scenes and final thoughts, and we've meshed them together in a melange.
It's so our show, do what we want.
Let's go into favorite scenes.
Hello, I'm Al Murray, and you're listening to Fighting on Film, the world's number one war film podcast.
Rob, what was your favorite scene?
I mentioned it before, but Niven on a Gatling gun. You ain't going to see that in any other movies. I also like during the battle that more chaps get beaten to death with rifles than get shot with them for a bit. And that really leaned into the swashbuckly style of it to me.
There's a lot of hand-to-hand.
And then there's also a nice bit where Alapang is trying to escape, and Cooper looks down at one of the Filipino soldiers and he goes, you know, stop him.
Yeah, Yabo. Yabo.
Yabo's got his Winchester aimed. And I was like, yeah, Yabo, blast him away. Like, come on, I want to see it.
I wanted to see him slam fire that Winchester like three or four times.
You get a complete fake out, and Yabo beats him to death with the buttstock. Yep. And he falls in the river and drowns. And I was like, why didn't you work? I was expecting Indiana Jones, sword against shotgun. Shotgun wins. Yep. I was expecting that kind of thing. But it surprised me. This film was full of surprises. You know, I didn't hate it. I love the end battle because it was so strange. Like when men were like we have no ammo left, but men were running around with clearly like 50 to 60 like rounds full bandoliers. Left in
and there's like a scene where like there's a Filipino woman that is like, oh no, there's no ammo, and she's holding up boxes that clearly have rifle rounds and cartridges in those boxes.
If they didn't have Niven, they'd have lost, because Niven was the only one trying. He was running ammo around, he was firing that Gatling like no one's business. He goes out like a pro, wanting more ammo as well. Favorite part of the movie is just Niven. I just love him. But I've
he's
got great. More to
there's,
say
there's a bit
forms,
where he's like,
yeah,
he's struggling with the onset of cholera, and then he's determined to go off and find Gary Cooper, who's gone off into the jungle on his own. And he gets out. He has the sick moment of where he opens up the chest and pulls out the 1897.
It's very cool.
He goes over, takes a swig out of a bottle of whiskey, and then collapses on the floor due to the onset of cholera.
Yeah.
You know? He's great in it. He really is. I would have liked more, but we'll talk about that.
A Victorian disease for a Victorian man.
Right. Yes. I think my favorite scene is it's a combination of that scene where the opening scene where they shoot the Morrow. I talked about how that's a nice inclusion because of, you know, the debate about stopping power of pistols, etc. But then also, as I said earlier, my real favorite is the bit where they ironclad it up a bit and catapult loads of dudes.
It's just so funny.
At the church.
I wasn't expecting it.
And there's bits where like one like just like whacks like the mantle of the church and slides down it, and
really
the camera
painful.
Lingers on him.
It looked really
and, like,
painful.
There's dudes like hitting trees and hitting parapet and like that's a baller move. That's
it is
a
spectacle. That ending is, you know.
Well, it's that classic 30s Hollywood thing where they, you know, the climax is going to be a big set piece,
mm-hmm.
and it does deliver. There's
fuck
you know,
all that happened up to that point, really. Come on,
it's interpersonal stuff. It's one-on-one stuff.
There's a love triangle.
It's love triangle. It's
where Flower Boy thinks he's got any fucking attempts at getting that woman. It ain't happening.
Plot twist, Rob. She's the one that she would have gone with, but he died.
Probably. Yeah. I want to name an orchid after you. Creep. What are you doing?
It was a different time. I really love actually that they set up her character by like Cooper asks her, "Why are you here?" And she says, "Well, there was a big earthquake in San Francisco, and I realized that I wanted to see my father again." And I was like, "Oh wow, okay, so we're using the great earthquake of San Francisco, as like context." And
I'd
I
rather be
that.
Here
I just
than
did
there.
That.
Yeah, yeah. She was a good character, actually. I didn't like. She wasn't a damsel in distress. She actually had a lot more going on and was just not
she
there.
Helped. She's actually. Sharon speaking Spanish as well, so she's intelligent. It might even pass the test because there's a scene where two women have a conversation with each other, and it's not entirely about men.
Yes.
So that might be
my god! Yeah,
a rare one.
That's been a long time coming on the show. Oh my god! Well done, Samuel Goldwyn. You trailblazer, you.
I think it's very brief, and then it pivots back to talking about the men. But not bad. Good effort.
No, it's good. It's there. Yeah.
There's that classic trope of the wife arrives, and he's so close to retirement, Rob. He's so close. Both of them are the young lady's father's close to retirement.
They're proper old codgers at this point, too, aren't they?
And he dies. The major dies. He's killed, just as he's trying to buy some nice silk for his wife, who he hasn't seen in many years.
He gets chefed up, doesn't he?
Painful.
Terrible.
But yeah, I did that final set piece is, I think, the high point of the film.
Of course it is. Like, there's nothing else going on. I'm not going to pick Gary Cooper battling cholera on his own for half hour. That's the most
Why
boring.
Why not?
We're going to go to final
boring.
Thoughts now.
I'm going to argue here.
It was so fucking boring.
It wasn't boring, Rob. It was quite interesting because they're like,
boring.
He's like, we're going to dig pits. We're going to put carbolic acid and we're going to clean
the
rooms.
Learning how to fight cholera is interesting. But
there's
not
a bit
in...
where like... they've put lime at the base of the mess steps, and David Niven shuffles his feet in the lime to go before he goes in, and
out of the cholera. From a technical standpoint, interesting, but to watch it for half an hour in the middle of my action and westerny hybrid.
What's amazing is that it's not only do they do an extended sequence of it, but there's also a montage of him like working as well within that extension. And you're like,
we need like a push
involved.
Into the limit. We need Rocky pushing to the limit over that, because it really felt like it needed it.
Yeah, I mean, speaking
Mary
of montages,
June plus fighting cholera. Got to dig the lime pits when you're fighting cholera.
Oh my god! There's another montage at the beginning where the troops are getting trained as well.
That's good. I wanted more of that because. Mm.
That's the whole point of them being there, to train.
Exactly.
This
is where my final thoughts come in, right? I can put up with a love triangle because it's a 30s movie, they do it, right? They can't help it, right? They're just in style, right? So you've got the love triangle.
It's actually a love quadrangle.
A quadrangle as well, yep. So there's a lot going on. And that wasn't insufferable because there's some funny moments where they're all trying to like outbest each other, and Niven's winning, then Cooper's winning, then Flower Boy comes in and tries to name an orchid after her, and it's all a bit awkward. it's funny. It's good, well written. And then obviously cholera bit comes in, and I was just like, God. And I'm like,
changes the tone a bit, doesn't it?
It really does. And then after that, you get one, I think it's a throwaway line from either Niven or Cooper, where they go, we need to train these men up. Why aren't we training these men? I was like, you just spent half hour fighting fucking cholera. You could have cut that out, even if it might have happened. I don't know. Like, I'm not clued up on the American-Spanish War. But
it's the Moro Rebellion, Rob. It's not
Moro Rebellion, sorry. But where's your bit of like Niven and Flower Boy and Cooper training them up, showing them shooting, showing them tactics, things like that? You need more of it.
There's bits where it's mostly drill, isn't it? And it's mostly drill, and and that whole sequence is a vehicle for Cooper interfering with the training, almost to the annoyance of the commanding officer, where he's by the book and he wants them trained
going blind
a certain way.
Yeah.
That's a very unusual like plot point as well. I don't know
why
that's included. Oh
they
my god, I know.
Like,
oh god, isn't it cold at the end where Cooper comes up and goes, I wish you could have seen it? I'm like, oh my god, Gary.
He's like, see, Gary. I felt it. Yeah, that was quite cool.
Like, wow. And then at the end, they've got him with a pair of very 19th century sunglasses on.
Yeah, that was cool.
Like, he's blind now because he's wearing the sunglasses.
But yeah, it was so weird. And then the movie just ends after that.
Yeah.
But I just found it, I didn't hate it. I quite enjoyed it on some level. I love any movie Niven's in. I just think he's great. Mm-hmm. One of those
Niven on a Gatling gun. That's why I wanted to do
it. Eternal British.
I didn't say it was a good film.
Actors.
I just said interesting.
But it just didn't know what genre it wanted to be. Was it a melodrama? Was it a romantic comedy? Was
God,
it action? Was it a Western? And there wasn't enough of everything. Niven and I'm gonna keep calling him Flower Boy, doing a massive disservice to that actor, but it's the only way I can remember him. They just don't do anything much until the end.
They don't.
They're kind of just there. No wonder he was on a day rate, because he didn't have much to do. And Cooper is good, but Cooper is, I don't want to say like miscast, but he's certainly
kind of
doing a lot more.
He can't. I think you have a point there, because. You know, you could have had, there's a couple of other people you could have had in that role at that point. Errol Flynn, absolutely. Errol Flynn would have been on point. And, you know, we would have had a Wings, or is it Dawn Patrol, rather?
That would have been nice, yeah.
Element of it with Niven and Errol Flynn, like, bouncing off one another. That would have been peak.
That would have been cool.
But, yeah, you're right. It totally is. It's a very confused film in that it's a Western war film, medical drama, adventure picture.
Yeah. Wow.
Rolled into one.
Yeah.
And not all of those themes come together harmoniously.
No, they don't. You could chop the cholera a bit out, and I don't think the movie changes at all.
Yeah. I honestly, you could rewrite that bit, because the way the cholera epidemic begins because the Moro Dam, the river that flows through the village, and causes, you know, a shortage of water, so that, you know,
the water's fouled up.
Yeah, and that causes like various different problems.
Yeah.
And illnesses and the cholera begins, and then there's an epidemic, and then that is your mid mid film dip.
It sags so much. I'm just like, oh my God. And then, oh, just that bit really threw me off. And I was like willing for some action. And then you get it. It's a bit muddled, isn't it?
Yeah, there's like a sojourn where they go up into the hills to blow up the dam. And
But I know at the time it was really well received. People loved it. You know, it was the reviews were so glowing. I mean, you can do a lot
worse. I
think
audiences at the time were more used to that kind of melange of themes and styles.
I think that's it, and we do say that a lot. Whereas on the show.
Probably nowadays, when we're more expecting of a more, you know, straightforward, you know, not having comedic elements in your film that includes cholera and, you know, insurgency, you know,
and maybe treat the Moros with a bit more respect than just we've got to
talk about the fact that it is a very, you know.
It's very of its time.
Very much a movie of its time. There's a lot of imperialism. There's a lot of othering going on. Cooper insists on calling a young Moro boy, Miguel, Mike, throughout the whole film.
Gary, my mate.
There's one bit where the two officers are talking about the militia and he calls them our little brothers, which is very...
the 1939 is this? I was thinking when I was watching it.
And to be fair, it does reflect probably attitudes of the period that the film's set in.
Without a doubt, yeah.
But again, it's all of its time. And it's interesting to see imperialism, colonialism reflected in a film.
Especially like American colonialism, because they were new boys to that, weren't they, really?
That's a very, you know, a very rare thing to see on film as well. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating film with a lot of interesting things going on. And it's got
right
for
a remake, I think. One of those films I'd like to remake with a bit more.
Minus the cholera section.
Yeah. Truncated. Yeah. Yeah.
Also, California has never looked more like the Philippines.
It's amazing. Just for the set alone, it's incredible. Yeah. You know, making that canal. It's a real feat of filmmaking, and doing it at a time.
Did you read the bits where Douglas Fairbanks and a number of other like former studio heads were like complaining that Goldwyn was going to destroy the backlot that they built in the 20s?
No,
I read in one of Niven's biographies that there was some backlash around a lot of old outdoor sets being demolished to build that big set. And Fairbanks was
like, tear it all down for my Cooper picture. Right?
And Fairbanks was like talking to American art museums and stuff and being like, can we not like get some of this saved and get in a collection somewhere?
Apparently. Fairbanks got his knickers in a twist. I'm trying to make this Cooper picture here. knock down that wall. Do as I say.
Oh, and then finally, one thing we missed out on the Ali Tally was the dynamite candle that Gary throws at one point.
Oh, that was quite cool. Yeah.
Quite funny.
That was good.
But I think that's it.
I think we've run out of steam on The Real Glory in 1939. Yeah. Another review there for you. I mean, I didn't dislike it, but I didn't like it. I think that's fair to say.
It's an interesting film. I'm not going to say it's the best film, but it's certainly... Probably the most interesting film made about that topic. Yeah,
pre pod list that we made. It's finally been ticked off. Yes. And next week, as we mentioned at the top of the show, it's our 150th episode. So we are going to be reviewing a classic, a sort of Avengers level event film of its day.
150 episodes of us
150
talking.
War films, and we've still not done any real biggins. we've done like a Bridge Too Far. We've done things like that we have. But you know, the show's motto is that we want to cover everything obscure and classic, as well as the big hitters. Because we said when we started the show, if you did the big hitters, you'd be done in a year. And you'd have to.
It's very true.
You have to mix it in.
you know, whenever we talk to people, you know, listen to the show, I'm always struck by the fact that, you know, 80% of them always say it's great that you highlight so many films that, you know,
that's the reason, that's the whole point of the show. Where else are you going to get an hour on The Real Glory? I can't think anywhere else. Someone, if we don't do it, someone else will. So we might as well be us. There you go, folks. Right. So do join us next week for our 150th episode, where we'll be covering Guns of Navarone, if we didn't already mention it. Niven again. Baker.
Yep.
Peck. There you go. Gregory Peck. Yeah.
Quinn.
And I have a Cinerama press book for Guns of Navarone that I'll be dusting off for the episode. Maybe read a few paragraphs from that. It's colour. It cost me like £5 from a little charity shop a few years ago. Been sitting on it. Looking forward to dusting that one off and joining Niven and Co. again to knock out a big gun on a big mountain. Lovely.
What more could you want, honestly?
What more could you? All the best war movies, when you think about it, are on mountains and cliffs. Like, where eagles there.
It adds jeopardy. What can I say?
It really does, doesn't it? Yeah, exactly. So, thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next week for the 150th.
And if you haven't listened to all 150 episodes, head to fightingonfilm.com, where you can find all of them on our website, and you can catch up just in time for next week.
That way, you'd have to do a lot, but no, fair play. Bye.
Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.